This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day because it represents the end of a very turbulent week in this republic. One thing that President Biden has achieved, and honestly, no matter what you think about Biden, you can't take away this achievement. He has united Republicans and Democrats in a way I never expected to see. Everybody's condemning him. Maxine Waters is condemning him. His own vice president is condemning him. How? Because of the disaster at the border. It is a complete mess. And now Secretary Mayorkas, who is taking the fall for a lot of this stuff, Alejandro Mayorkas, the Secretary of Homeland Security, the idea that this is actually something that the only way you can cure it is with a comprehensive immigration reform, right. This is exactly the kind of atmosphere, is it, on this immigration disaster where we're likely to get Democrats and Republicans to unite on reform? No, they're united in contempt with the Biden administration. It's extraordinary. And this creates a situation which relates to another national problem. The problem is the epidemic of suicide. Really. And what about a party committing suicide? Scholar David Farris is saying that Democrats are committing political suicide. How? Well, he'll be speaking with us about that. There's also, obviously, an epidemic of murder. There are articles in the New York Times, in Atlantic, and all kinds of sources that have nothing to do with the Republican Party that, in fact, lean to the left. And those sources confirm the fact that murder has gone on an increase in the sharpest terms, the most rapid increase in the murder rate since they have been measuring the murder rate. And yet we are not treating that like a crisis, which we should. We'll be talking to Heather McDonald about this, about the sharp increase in homicides coming up. And meanwhile, and it's part of a nation just, it seems to me, coming apart in a sick and disgusting way, which is so many stories about people committing violence based on vaccines. Really? There are stories about how anti-vaxxers have become so extreme that they are actually mobilizing for various things. A big story at NBC where it talks about anti-vaxxers who are trying to get people out of emergency rooms, telling people that if you go to emergency rooms or you go to hospitals at all, they will somehow sneak vaccines onto you. And groups on the internet and elsewhere suggesting that you have to avoid hospitals altogether. Is this real? Well, it appears to be. And then this story, which is actually, we are going to do this as a blame Canada, because Canada takes great pride in the fact that it has a much higher rate of vaccination than the United States, about 70% as opposed to 55%. And, yeah, they're very proud of the fact that they say generally for all vaccines, not just for COVID-19, Canadians have some of the highest vaccination rates of any nation on earth. But there is this story from Quebec. Police are looking for a man in Canada. They say punched a nurse in the face multiple times, knocking her to the ground after she administered a COVID-19 vaccine to his wife. Okay, why would he want to beat up the nurse after he saw that she administered a vaccine to his wife? Because she administered the vaccine to his wife without his permission. By the way, there is no law, no rule in medical ethics or anywhere else that you have to get a spousal permission before you get a vaccination. If you're a child, well, maybe his wife is a child, maybe that's it, who knows. On Monday of this week, a man walked into Brunette Pharmacy in Sherbrooke, a city in southern Quebec, and accused a nurse in her 40s, who police have not named, of vaccinating his wife. Sherbrooke police spokesman Martin Carrier told CNN. Right at the beginning, the suspect was very angry, very aggressive. He asked the nurse why she vaccinated his wife without approval, without his consent. And he then punched her right in the face multiple times, so the nurse didn't have the time to defend or explain herself. And then she fell to the ground and the suspect left, running out of the drugstore. There are no laws in Canada that say individuals need spouses' permission to get vaccinated, and it is unclear whether or not his wife had actually given consent. The nurse was taken to a hospital nearby by ambulance, where she was treated for multiple injuries to her face. As a result of the incident, the pharmacy told the CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, that they suspended vaccinations. Really? Burnett Pharmacy's parent company, the Jean Cocteau Group Incorporated, also declined to comment, but said they fully condemn this act. Well, it's kind of easy to condemn, which is unacceptable toward the pharmacy teams who have been providing essential services since the beginning of the pandemic. Canada has vaccinated 70% of its population, surpassing the U.S. by 15.6%, according to data from Our World in Data. Okay, imagine that you're a nurse who comes into work and thinks you're helping people. The people you're helping actually think you're helping people. And the husband comes in. They say the suspect is described as 30 to 45-year-old man, 6 feet tall, medium build, with two small ear piercings on each ear and a tattoo on his hand in the shape of a cross. There's also this audio from NPR in Georgia, where another healthcare worker was kicked in the ribs and harassed at vaccine sites. Listen.
Officials are hoping a Senate study committee, though screams could be heard from inside a room at the Northeast Georgia Health System. A patient had pinned a nurse's head against the door. It's just one example of violence from patients that hospitals say has become part of the daily routine. Dr. Mohawk DeVay is chief of emergency medicine with the Northeast Georgia Health System. He says assaults are so common that hospitals struggle to get their staff to report them.
People just have basically felt that that's just part of the job. And we keep reminding them that it's not part of the job.
Even with workers reluctant to speak up, such incidents have doubled in the Northeast Georgia Health System since last year. Health leaders blame the stress of the COVID-19 pandemic. Kelsey Reed is the director of patient care at Phoebe Putney Memorial Hospital in Albany. She says even death threats have become commonplace.
There's not a week that goes by that we do not hear about an instance in which a patient or a family member maybe was verbally or physically aggressive with the staff.
Hospitals are hoping a Senate study committee meeting Thursday will shed light on the issue. For GPB News, I'm Riley Bunch.
Okay, is there anyone out there who actually believes this is acceptable or it's an appropriate response to people going to work and providing vaccines for people who want them, and that vaccines that actually benefit the entire country? By the way, there's more proof from an emergency room physician that that is the case. We will get to that and to more and speak with Heather McDonald about the increase in homicides. Nobody can fully figure out why. We'll get to that and more coming up on the MedVed Show. The Michael Medved Show, talking about, saw this extraordinary moment where people are so concerned about conspiracies involving the vaccines that there are people punching, hitting, kicking in the ribs, harassing at medical care sites, medical personnel who are trying to do their job, for goodness sake. I mean, can you imagine basically being one of those families with a healthcare professional who comes in and takes this abuse from people who think you are part of some conspiracy to install a chip into people's system because they're getting a COVID-19 vaccine or some other nefarious purpose? It's a horrible thing. This report from public television and NPR is extraordinary because they go all over the country and they find, there's this. This is actually from NBC. Vigilante treatments. Anti-vaccine groups push people to leave ICUs. Anti-vaccine Facebook groups have a new message for their community members. Don't go to the emergency room and get your loved ones out of intensive care units. Consumed by conspiracy theories claiming that doctors are preventing unvaccinated patients from receiving miracle cures or are even killing them on purpose, some people in anti-vaccine and pro-ivermectin Facebook groups, can you imagine their pro-ivermectin Facebook groups apparently springing up all over the place? In any event, they're telling those with COVID-19 to stay away from hospitals and instead try increasingly dangerous at-home treatments, according to posts reviewed over the past few weeks. The messages represent an escalation in the mistrust of medical professionals and groups that have sprung up in recent months on social media platforms, which have tried to crack down on COVID misinformation. And it's something that some doctors say they're seeing manifest in their hospitals as they filled up because of the most recent Delta variant wave. Quote, we were down to 4 COVID patients 2 months ago. In this surge, we've had 40 to 50 more patients with COVID on 4 different ICU services. 97% of them are unvaccinated. So given this situation, can it become a little bit more obvious why distrust for medical professionals is unhealthy? And not just regarding COVID-19, but regarding everything that you need healthcare for and support for and saving for. And by the way, there was a dramatic illustration of that on The View live. An extraordinary moment with the Vice President of the United States. They were looking forward to having Kamala Harris as their very special guest on The View. And you can hear the producer of The View interrupting the show live on air to ask two of the hosts to leave the stage. Listen, this is clip 2.
There seems to be something happening here that I'm not 100% aware of. Can someone please apprise me of the situation?
I need the two of you to step off for a second.
Okay. Anna and
we're going to bring
Sonny
you back later.
Have to
okay.
leave.
Yeah. Yes.
And we'll tell you why.
More information later. It's a tease.
We'll tell you why in a couple of minutes. So shall I introduce the vice president?
Yes.
Okay. So, vice president.
No.
Nope. Okay, shall we dance? Let's do a tap dance.
Let's do a tap dance.
All right.
Listen to that enthusiasm.
Let's do a short commercial, we'll come back.
Talk about what?
What else can we talk about for Hot Topics?
Okay, as we always do in television when we're in a tight spot, we'll be right back.
Okay, and then they come right back from the commercial break, and that's Joy Behar, of course. She then announces something about the two hosts, Sonny Hostin and Anna Navarro, who were removed asked to leave the stage. Here's what she announced, clip 13.
Going to be a major news story any minute now.
Yeah.
What happened is that Sunny and Anna both apparently tested positive for COVID. No matter how hard we try, these things happen. They probably have a breakthrough case and they'll be okay, I'm sure, because they're both vaccinated up the wazoo, you know, a lot of vaccines. So, and the vice president is being prepped for her arrival, right?
Yep.
They cleaned the table. We watched, they did the hands. Everybody's getting all cleaned up and she'll be out here in a second. So, in the meantime, until she gets out here, maybe the audience would like to participate in the show. Does it? All right. So here's how, what I mean by that is, does anyone have a good question to ask Sarah or me?
Because that's all you got. So.
And don't ask about our sex lives.
I mean, are they incapable of talking about another topic? I mean, this is called live TV. When she finally did make it on the show, Kamala Harris. Now, remember, the president of the United States put her in charge of handling the crisis at the border. Listen to how well she handles it. This is clip 9.
First of all, I've been very clear. I've been clear about the images that you and I both saw of those law enforcement officials on horses. I was outraged by it. It was horrible and deeply troubling. There's been now an investigation that is being conducted, which I fully support, and there needs to be consequence and accountability. Human beings should not be treated that way, and as we all know, it also evoked images of some of the worst moments of our history, where that kind of behavior has been used against the indigenous people of our country, has been used against African Americans during times of slavery. And so I'm glad to know that Ali Mayorkas, the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, is taking it very seriously.
Okay, this is after a producer had again interrupted the show right before she came on. Well, she wasn't on in person. She had been due to appear in person, but listen, this is clip 3.
And what? We'll be right back, right? Coming around?
I just have a little update. So
what?
I have an update. So just
update.
Everything's just being done to be as safe as humanly possible. So what we're going to try to do now is do an interview with the vice president remotely right in a couple minutes. So that's the plan. We're going to talk to her from another room.
So we're going to talk to her remotely.
Even though she's here. Yeah.
Even though she's in the building.
Just to be safe.
Okay, that's good enough for all of us.
Yeah.
We'll be right back.
And by the way, speaking of remotely, does anyone remotely believe that this is going to be the next president of the United States? I mean, Kamala Harris, what a disaster. I think it's impossible to imagine either Joe Biden or Kamala Harris winning the presidency next time. We will be right back on the Medved Show with Heather McDonald talking about the murder explosion. On the Michael Medved Show, always a pleasure to welcome Heather McDonald to the show. She is the Thomas W. Smith Fellow at the Manhattan Institute and a contributing editor to City Journal. She's also the author of the best-selling and essential books, The Diversity Delusion, most recently, and before that, The War on Cops. Heather, I've said it's a pleasure welcoming you back. The circumstance, however, isn't pleasurable at all. It's the data that have emerged about murder in the United States. And the Atlantic magazine, which is not a conservative voice in particular, says if 2020 was a year of death, COVID-19 was not the only culprit. Last year saw the largest increase in murders on record, according to new federal government data. What the Atlantic says is we all know this is happening. What we don't know is why. Let's ask Heather McDonald. Why?
Well, that's preposterous. The media has pretended early on that it was the pandemic, and then when the lockdowns were ending, they were saying, oh, now that the lockdowns are ending, crime is going to go up. So for the media, all of their explanations happen to be true except for the right one, which is the demonization of the cops, the depolicing that's going on. Officers are not engaging in the voluntary activity that stops crime, and we have unleashed the beast. There is anarchy and chaos happening, concentrated in inner city areas, but it is spreading out into a suburb near you with carjackings, people being kidnapped in Washington, D.C., driven from ATM to ATM to withdraw cash, beatings going on, robberies on Melrose, armed robberies on Melrose Avenue in Los Angeles. The idea that we don't know why this is going on is simply absurd, and the most absurd explanation is the pandemic. The fact of the matter, Michael, is that everywhere else in the world, violent crime went down during the pandemic. Only in the United States did it shoot up, and only after the George Floyd riots, when cops became the constant target of presidential calumny and of media calumny.
And for people who say we don't know why, it is fascinating because the point that you just made, the George Floyd death was Memorial Day. And the pandemic was well underway by that point, right?
Right, and crime was going down.
And crime goes down because of the pandemic, because there are fewer people on the streets, right? There are fewer crowds.
Exactly. And the idea that the left also proposes that this is all driven by economic necessity. On Tuesday, two 15-year-olds were killed within hours of their school. One boy was standing on the sidewalk, and his killers came up, shot him, and as he was on the ground, they continued pumping bullets into his body. The next boy was shot in a car. These are deliberate targeted killings. They have nothing to do with economic need. You are not killing somebody because you can't put bread on the table. You're killing them because you have no self-control. You have no respect for life. These kids are not poor. They all have smartphones. Social media is the police's best friend because all of these uncivilized, barbaric gangbangers spend their time when they're not on the streets looking for retaliatory drive-by shooting opportunities. They're at home throwing gang signs, flashing their wads of cash and their guns on their YouTube and Instagram accounts, which the police use to try and establish gang affiliations. So the idea that this is somehow poverty is driving people to engage in these mindless drive-by shootings is completely preposterous.
So, obviously, the main responsibility for policing for public safety is local governments and state governments. But on a national basis, is there anything that the Biden administration should be doing to deal with what is a crisis? The sharpest increase in homicide ever recorded in 1 year. And
yes.
So what should they do?
Yes, the Biden administration has a very clear path forward. Stop demonizing the cops. Push back against the narrative. Joe Biden should get up and give a speech saying, I have been wrong. It is not the case that black parents should fear for their children's lives every time they step outside, fearful that they will be shot by a cop. That is a lie. The fact of the matter is, the police are the solution in the inner city. Criminals are the problem. So far this year, there have been 4 unarmed blacks shot by the police, 4 out of a black population of about 47 million. When you compare the rate at which police officers have been fatally gunned down, and you look at the likely race, given what we know historically, that blacks have made up about 40% of all cop killers nationwide, black males have, even though they're 6% of the population, a police officer is 375 times as likely to be killed by a black male as an unarmed black is to be killed by a police officer. Biden is simply wrong. He has contributed to this poison, and the best thing he could do would be to say, do not resist arrest, obey the police, you know, tell your children to respect law authority, and do not engage in this poisonous narrative that we have a police force that is systemically racist.
Okay, is there any state or locality even where this situation has been handled more effectively than elsewhere?
I don't know. You know, conservatives like to say, oh, this is only a blue state problem or a blue city problem. I'm not sure that's the case. I think that this narrative is so pervasive that cops are demoralized everywhere. I don't know of a city that has not had a just eye-popping homicide increase. And, of course, the homicides are the tip of the iceberg. The real issue is all the people that are being wounded by gunshots, which is, you know, many, many times higher than the homicide numbers.
Heather, there's when you were mentioning red states, blue states, the statewide data shows that the same state has had the highest murder rate for the 32nd year in a row. Now, that's an incredible losing streak for Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
What's the problem with Louisiana?
Well, I think, you know, family breakdown is really bad there. And sort of an insular inner city culture doesn't have any kind of bourgeois influences. But you know, there's lots of places that compete with Baton Rouge and New Orleans, places like St. Louis, Louisville,
Baltimore.
These days, yeah, Baltimore with Milwaukee, Chicago gets a lot of coverage because it has, you know, the glamour element, and frankly, the Chicago Tribune does a decent job of covering crime, but Chicago is not close to the highest per capita homicide rate.
Let us hope that people get this message, and you can we'll post some of Heather McDonald's information and her commentary up at our website at michaelmedved.com. Keep speaking out. The message couldn't be much more important. This is one of many failures and disappointments, to say the least, of the Biden administration. So what does the president say about it? He was given a very tough question, and his answer, well, we'll play it for you coming right up. From the Michael Medved Show.
I'm, of course, deeply honored to receive
the Michael Medved Show. 1-800-955-1776. The Michael Medved Show.
Medved Show. With all of the problems facing the country, I must say I am actually gratified that some of the history of the country is being embraced and used for inspiration by more and more people. I'm talking about our Medhead Plus offer, which has had just a great response, and appropriately so. You know, with a Medhead Plus membership, which comes to about 20 cents a day, that's all. It's $79.95 for a year. And that membership not only gives you access to our show and the downloads and the podcast, but gives you access to more than 200 hours of Medved history programming. And that's about World War One and World War Two, the Vietnam War, and the three lies about the Vietnam War. The question, is America a Christian country? Was it founded as a Christian country? You can get to all of that for free downloading any of our history programs from the Medved History Store. And you can do that for free once you're a Medhead Plus member. Go to our website, michaelmedved.com, look on the Access to MedHead Plus membership, or go directly to MedvedHistoryStore.com, and you can see the kind of history programs you'll be able to download anytime you want. That's MedvedHistoryStore.com or MichaelMedved.com. I mentioned this question. Look, it's a tough question, but of course Joe Biden's going to get a tough question because this is a very tough time for the country. And the displays of incompetence at the very top of our government have been undeniable and problematic. Peter Alexander asked a tough question to Joe Biden. And here is his question and response.
We've seen the chaotic troop withdrawal from Afghanistan, the threat of a government shut down right now, and Democrats, members of your own party, are still divided over your agenda going forward. So what do you say to Americans who say that you have not delivered on that promise?
Remember, I said it's going to take me a year to deliver everything I'm looking at here. And that's number one. Number two, take a look at what I inherited when I came into office. When I came into office, the state of affairs and where we were. We had 4 million people vaccinated. We had no plan. I could go down the list. So, part of it is dealing with the panoply of things that will land it on my plate. I'm not complaining. It's just a reality. It's reality.
That's the president's response. And again, he's going to get caught up because he said, remember, I told you it would take a year to get everything accomplished. Anybody think that he's going to, I hope he's correct. I hope he has massive accomplishments in terms of saving our economy from a catastrophe and maybe actually making some progress on some of the worthwhile endeavors like the infrastructure improvement, which would help all Americans. There are things that Biden could lead on. But it's so difficult when there are mixed messages and confusion. And today, a new, just outright distortion headline in the New York Times, White House says the richest pay only 8% in federal taxes. What? Everybody out there is reading that and thinking, hey, I pay a lot more than 8%. And Americans do. But how could it be the rich pay only 8% federal taxes? The analysis, says the New York Times, in this White House paper that was delivered today, the analysis suggests that the wealthiest 400 households in America, that's households with net worth ranging between $2.1 billion and $160 billion, pay an effective federal income tax of just over 8% per year on average. The White House is basing that tax rate on calculations using data on high earners' income, wealth, and taxes paid from the Internal Revenue Service and the Federal Reserve's Survey of Consumer Finances. Okay, they're also talking about net worth. We don't have a tax on net worth. Elizabeth Warren thinks we should, but we don't. And it is possible that some of those households with more than $2 billion in net worth have no income or even losses. And what Biden is not talking about is a total restructuring of the tax system so that would change. And even in the New York Times, they acknowledge here, and this is really very important because I was talking to some smart people this morning who didn't fully understand how wrong this was. The New York Times acknowledges the White House's calculations of what the wealthiest pay in taxes are well below what other analyses have found. The difference comes from the White House officials' decision to count the rising value of wealthy American stock portfolios, which is not taxed on an annual basis as income. It finds that between 2010 and 2018, those top 400 households, when including the rising value of their wealth, earned a combined $1.8 trillion and paid an estimated $149 billion in federal individual income taxes. But what they're talking about here is individual income taxes, where the actual numbers, as recorded, and this is very important, by the Independent Tax Policy Center in Washington, estimated that this year, that most recently, the highest earning 1,400 households in the country paid an average collective tax rate of about 24%. The average tax rate for everybody is 14%. So you may say, well, it should be a bigger difference than 24% and 14%. But the fact is, there is a difference. It is a myth. It is a lie. It is a distortion to say that people who earn millions a year pay a lower rate than people who earn a typical $60,000, $70,000 a year household income. And part of what this entire distortion is based on is the fact that we do not, in other words, and it would be difficult to see it otherwise, wouldn't it? Is, in other words, if you have a small stock portfolio, let's say you have $2,000 that you've invested or that you have in a 401k, and that $2,000 that you started out with, it ends up going up, up, up. The stock market, I hope, continues to go up. That when that stock market goes up and the $2,000 you invested, it goes up to $4,000, you don't pay taxes on it because you're encouraged to hold on to it and let it go up more. You only pay taxes when you sell. Now, that is something the Biden administration wants to change, and wants to change, I think, to the detriment of one of the few positive developments long-term that we've had in this country, which is an increased savings rate. And the idea that the White House is now pushing to increase everybody's taxes by claiming that, oh gosh, the richest people in the country pay only 8% in federal taxes. I mean, look, our tax system can deserve all kinds of reform and change. And sure, talking about a 0.5% here and 0.5% there, what the tax system really needs, and what honestly Republicans really need to step up and offer, is a system that is less complicated, that is more transparent, where it is easier for people who are actually paying the taxes and for the people who are administering the taxes to actually see what is going on and to allow things to make sense. The idea that Biden talks about billionaires and trillionaires and wants to blame everything on them, and that goes along with this new study that was released today. Listen to clip 14. Well, we'll get to that when he talks about infrastructure. We'll also be speaking, coming up, with how the Democrats are committing political suicide. How? Well, by fighting one another, and not just on Israel, though we'll get to that too. There's also a murder that occurred because someone allegedly voted for the wrong presidential candidate. Where? Why? How? That and much more coming up in This Greatest Nation on God's Green Earth.